Yeah, so here we are, 2024. We made it, and now we have a year ahead, and doesn't mean, I mean, things may be gnarly in 2024. We've already got two wars, now we'll have probably wars in an election. So how do we navigate that, you know? How do we bring our practice into our lives in the middle of that? And as Phil?
Yes.
Yes. Was saying, you know, just really almost find more depth just because of how hard we're pushed by circumstance. So, you know, part of to find a way to harness the practice so that we can manifest equanimity, so we can live in some level of equanimity in the middle of whatever comes at us. That's part of what the practice brings us, and that's what we can bring to others. So I'd like to offer some thoughts. I've got five things that I thought would be helpful. Because I want this to work for you. And that's why I do this. That's why I do this, and I want it to work for you. So I'm going to offer five thoughts that kind of is a combination of coming from teachings and teachers that I've been around and studying and my own experience. And so there's a little bit sort of weaving a few things together, but I hope it's helpful. And the five things are cultivating the view, which is keep clarifying what it is we're seeing or trying to see, the view, where this is heading. Finding ways to be inspired by teachers or by the Buddha, persons who are awakened. Understanding our meditation practice as a tool and refining how to use the tool, like having that be part of what we work on that helps it work better for us. Finding ways to deepen practice. And lastly, you know, being spurred by the approach of death, you know, the transience of our life and having that spur us to practice. So those are five things I want to touch on. So cultivating the view. You know, in the Eightfold Path, that's what the Buddha taught, last of the Four Noble Truths, and the very first of the Eightfold is right view, which is really interesting because it's sort of like saying what the end is at the beginning. And that's always fascinated me, but he was really emphasizing the importance of setting up where we're heading and keeping to learn about that as we progress. Mahasi Sayadaw, he's a great Burmese master, defines the right view. He says, understanding mental and physical phenomena as they really are in terms of their individual and universal characteristics is right view. So it almost sounds like that's being awakened, but it's also how we approach what we're doing. Ute Janiya, another Burmese master, says, right view is the understanding that mind is nature. It is not I. It is not a self. It is not personal. It's not me, not mine. No one is there. This is right view. And it's funny when you study about right view, there's many different ways of people articulating that. So it's an interesting one. But to keep, you know, there's, I mean, our mindfulness practice is how we see the nature of things. Being mindful of phenomena helps us see through the tangles that we would otherwise be caught in, but there's a place for study. You know, there's a place for thinking about it, reading about it. You study a lot, you know, and to help align us, help clarify where we're going. And that's important. Because practice unpeels our concepts, unpeels our concepts, unpeels our assumptions, but to keep cultivating an understanding of where we're going, and they kind of overlay each other, you know, over time. As we study, we'll see better what we're practicing, and that just, they help each other. So to keep finding out where we're trying to go with this, you know, the nature of things could be that, Mahasi Sayadaw talked about. Yeah, it could be described as impermanence, not self, and dukkha, the three characteristics. And we want to learn about what that means and then penetrate what that means in our practice, but to keep coming back to understanding really helps us continue. Rampola Rahula is a great Sri Lankan master, and he says about this sort of balance of cognitive study, understanding, and awakening. He says, what we generally call understanding is knowledge, an accumulated memory, an intellectual grasping of a subject according to a certain given data. This is called knowing accordingly. It is not very deep. Real deep understanding or penetration is seeing a thing in its true nature without name and label. This penetration is possible only when the mind is free from all impurities and is fully developed through meditation. So I just want to offer that one because, you know, how do you, sometimes people get kind of lost in their practice because they forget where it is they're trying to go, you know, and they can kind of get muddled and spirally and people drift away and they come back. But to keep remembering where you're going, like Ajahn Nisibo, you know, this very fine young monastic that we've been studying with some, he's constantly studying. It's amazing. And he brings it into his whole being. And then he looks, you know, then in his practice, he looks more deeply. So just want to really encourage that. Just keep remembering why you're doing it. You know, when we sit in the morning, can I ask how many people have a regular practice? Yeah, say quite a few. When you sit in the morning to refresh yourself about what you're doing, like why, what am I doing right now? This 40 minutes, this 30 minutes, what will be the result? What am I attempting to do? And link that into the right view. It's really happy. It's helpful. It's very easy to just kind of go on autopilot, you know, and just sit for 30 minutes or think for 30 minutes or whatever and not really set yourself on why you're doing it. When people do that, I've just from being around folks, often that's when they sort of, it just sort of drizzles down. Their practice just fades away because they're not really holding what it is and seeing what it is. And you know, three characteristics sounds kind of simple, or the Four Noble Truths kind of sounds, but if we could really penetrate that, we'd be awakened. So to the more we can understand it and then see it, just that two together. And as we move forward, things get simpler. Joseph Goldstein is one of the great Western teachers that he's with us, and it's wonderful. And I read his interview where he said his view is getting simpler. He said, I have a new definition of enlightenment. It's lightening up. We could think of the path as a process of lightening up from the more superficial levels to the most profound levels, because basically lightening up means letting go of all self-reference, which is, of course, no easy task. I thought that was pretty cool. It just makes it so simple, right? So, you know, we awaken through practice, and this mindfulness practice, which is so simple and so elegant and just helps us see through all the places that we're stuck and all the thoughts, you know, that came up in, for any of you who may have had thoughts come up over the 40 minutes, you know, that's like part of this matrix that we think is us. And so to understand that and to be able to, when that comes up, to have the view, understanding is just these manifestations and we can see through them. So Mahasi Sayadaw says, insight knowledge is necessarily associated with mindfulness. There is no insight knowledge without mindfulness. But, you know, if we don't cultivate the view, we may not know where to go. That's why the Buddha taught for 40 years. It's not obvious. The very way that we trick ourselves, the very way that our attachment tricks us, it's good to get clear about it so then we can see through it. So right view is super important. Yep, so the training and the practice go together. And the second one is, you know, to find ways to be stretched and inspired by teachers, by the suttas, by texts that are really directly from an awakened being and by the Buddha. That's really helpful to keep your practice going. and not so much in this tradition, but in Zen tradition as a whole, Dharma transmission aspect, and the word transmission is also very important in Tibetan tradition. So the real sense that contact with an awakened being, it helps us see what that is. It's not quite the same in Theravada, but we can learn from that. And, you know, for me personally, reading the suttas, I just constantly feel it's almost like the Buddha's right there. It's amazing. Even the simplest thing, he'll say the simple thing, but the way he says it, and you can feel the view he has behind it, and it's transformational, you know, in terms of just simple things about ethics or simple things about wholesome mind. And it's just like, oh yeah, you can see what he's saying. So here in 2024, this isn't so easy to find ways to make contact with awakened beings. If you read some of the life stories in Tibet, you know, 14th century or something, and there were awakened beings all over the place, and it was so much easier. So it's hard, but we can do it. And we have, you know, there is the internet, there's YouTube, there's amazing stuff on YouTube, you know, in terms of teachings and all these recorded teachings that great people do. So, you know, just to consciously keep bringing yourself closer to minds that have qualities of awakening, and conversely, maybe backing away from those that don't. You know, sometimes we find our friendships change on the path. And anyone experience that? Yep. The people that used to, I see some nodding out there. Yeah, yeah. How do I call that, right? Anything you want to say about that? Or you don't have to, but that's okay. But anyway, friendships change, or who we thought were our friends or what was valuable. And it shifts, and then we can turn toward people who have qualities or writings that have qualities that move us forward. And it's funny here, 2018, it's funny here in 2024 that a lot of the sort of the mystery of life is in some ways being sucked out by technology. And it's something to be mindful of. You know, AI stuff flying all around last bunch of months, and what that means and how overwhelming that can seem, that there's this incredible capability that maybe cognitively most of us couldn't begin to keep up with. But that doesn't mean that it's awakened mind. I mean, it's still a machine doing binary code. So I think it's really, you know, here in 2024, it's really important to look through all this seductive technology and all this stuff that is keeps us from seeing what our real potential is, just in terms of illumined mind, in terms of seeing the nature of things, and to keep, you know, reorienting ourselves towards that. A phone is just a thing. What did I read? Yeah, an iPhone 15, it can process data 100,000 times faster than the computers that guided the Apollo missions. Right? It's a silly little phone. Yeah, so, you know, to stretch ourselves. I mean, that's part of what to think in terms of, how can I stretch myself? How can I stretch to places where my practice is limited, my sense of what's possible is limited, and keep stretching. You know, for me, I'm 75, and, you know, don't know how many more years. So I'm really, any way I can stretch is kind of what I'm trying to do at this point. Because it's almost like as you progress in the practice, then the possibilities become clearer. Like the view becomes clearer, the sense of where you need to go, and the other options become useless. You know, it's like a lot of entertainments that a lot of people spend a huge amount of time acquiring or diverting themselves with just don't make any sense anymore, because there is this possibility of this great sacred freedom. So, you know, I love the words of the Buddha. I always recommend that for people. You can feel his mind in the Samyutta Nikaya. He discusses the nature of attachment, the nature of freedom. I just want to read one little thing, and it's you can feel how much is there, even though it's hard to understand what he means. And it's like right there, it's pulling ahead. He says, "Bhikkhus, the instructed noble disciple attends closely and carefully to dependent origination itself thus. When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance comes cessation of volitional formations. With the cessation of volitional formations, cessation of consciousness. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. There's a ton embedded in there. He's talking about the five skandhas, the aspects that make up our personality, and the 12 links. But I think with just, it's like if you open to the suttas like that, it's just like, you want to know what it is. You want to be able to see it. You can feel there's understanding buried in there that I don't get it. I mean, I kind of get it and I don't get it, but you can see how much more there is to get. So, you know, that's kind of an example of how reading the writings of the great beings is really helpful. Padmasambhava is like that. He was the founder of Tibetan Buddhism in the 8th century, and his writings are just astonishing. And, you know, Zen writings, they often present us with sort of paradoxes, koans, that point right at our stuck places. Here's one from Dogen, the 13th century founder of the Soto Zen. He said, "How can you become Buddha by doing Zazen? If you understand sitting Zen, you will know that Zen is not about sitting or lying down. If you want to learn sitting Buddha, know that sitting Buddha is without any fixed form. Do not use discrimination in the non-abiding Dharma. If you practice sitting as Buddha, you must kill Buddha. If you are attached to the sitting form, you are not yet mastering the essential principle." So there's this quality of kind of like kicking our assumptions out from under us to go deeper. You know, this whole thing about killing the Buddha is kind of like your concepts to go past that. When you sort of think you've got it grasped, to keep moving. And this was, you know, Rodney Smith, he was a founder of SIMS, and that was one of his strengths, was that he continually kind of, he orbited around this question of non-self, around non-sticking. He was always just poking at it from all different areas, kind of bidding people to go forward and not just stay in some sort of stuckness or some sort of settledness, but to keep stretching. Yeah, and so, you know, don't fall into complacency, or don't fall into just, you know, you ever ask someone how's it going and they say same old, same old? It's like, oh my God, it just breaks your heart. Because how could you say that about this precious moment of being alive? So, you know, just keep, right? So just to keep finding ways to keep stretching, and that whole arena of contact with what stretches us, with what emulates our possibility of awakening, is really handy. In 2014, I went on pilgrimage, Buddhist sacred places in India and also Myanmar, and almost to my surprise, what I didn't expect was that I was going to come in contact with some really highly developed beings. It was quite amazing. It was one time I was practicing in Bodh Gaya, and there was this monk next to me who meditated for really long, like, I don't know, it felt like 2 hours or something, really long time. Somehow we were in this groove together, and we sort of finished at the same time and bowed to each other. I don't think he spoke any English. I don't know what country he was from, actually. But there was a sense of this sort of magnificence he had that was, it's kind of stuck in my heart. You know, it's helped me move ahead. And also in that retreat, when I went to Sravasti, which is where the Buddha did 20 rains retreats or 17 different numbers anyway, stayed at a Zen monastery, and the abbot there, he was just amazing. This Korean monk, just super focused and had this presence. He was just very, very inspiring. And then I did some retreat at a Burmese monastery in Sagaing. And that Sayadaw was also just had this incredible presence. I didn't really expect that. It kept surprising me, which is kind of bizarre. But nonetheless, I kept being really delighted by these people that I was meeting. And then with Steve Armstrong, I met him in Myanmar. He went to a nunnery in Yangon, and there was this, the abbess, I guess. She was just unbelievable. I mean, she just had pretty young and had this incredible radiance, and the two of them had this conversation. Her English was good. They had this conversation about shamatha. I remember it was like I was completely left in the dust. It was so great. So, but point being, you know, that there really are highly awakened beings as we speak. There's people in three-year retreat right now. You know, there's extraordinary people all around the world right now. So to keep just reminding ourselves of that and just kind of like look, ask, you know, try to figure out where we can go, what we can think, set our priorities. And of course, all this stuff's on YouTube and all that. So there's a lot there. So just to stretch. And then, you know, in terms of the practice, keep clarifying what the practice is. You know, this simple thing like mindfulness. It's so simple, but what are we doing? You know, it's so amazing that the Satipatthana Sutta is just this 15-page text, number 10 in the Majjhima Nikaya, that where the Buddha taught how to do this practice. We did in other places, but that's the famous one. You know, and there's like, I can think of about five different books written about this 15-page sutta. Point being that there's, and I've read it over and over and over again, and I've taught it a whole bunch of times, and every time I read it again, I go, oh, I didn't, oh, I see how this comes together. I see how this fits together. You know, it's amazing that way. So, you know, just suggesting as much as you can keep working on understanding what the practice is and how it works is really incredible. It's very helpful to do that. It's a little bit like the view thing in a way, but that's more about what the nature of things is. This is more about almost like the hardware of practice, like the four foundations. How do they really work and how do they intersect in our lives? And, you know, when we're encountering pleasant and unpleasant and neutral, how do we bring that onto the path? You know, several different people talked about, well, pleasant's the one we often run into. But it's good to watch out. Unpleasant is, it's good to watch out for pleasant, but how do we bring that? So to really keep working on understanding what the practice is so that at the end of 2024, you got a better sense of what you're doing, what we're doing, than at the beginning. You know, just keep refining it. I mean, Joseph Goldstein, he's on Dharma Seed. There's a 46-lecture series on the Satipatthana Sutta. It's just incredible. 46 lectures, and that's where the book came from, mindfulness from that. But it's really amazing. And, you know, this simple mindfulness practice does take us into penetrating and seeing directly the nature of things, the nature of reality. That's where it goes. So the more we can understand that and take that in and really look at it that way, you know, just the more we can look at, that's what this incredible thing is that we're doing. And sometimes, you know, that's one sort of tricky bit here in 2024 because, you know, mindfulness-based stress reduction is really good. It's super helpful for a lot of people, so I'm in no way dissing it. But it's not about awakening. And so sometimes in the vernacular of mindfulness out there, people kind of lose track that what the Buddha was talking about was about nirvana. And he's just relentless in the suttas. He's always focusing on nirvana, on really the complete freedom that we can have. So to look at our practice, that's what it's about, you know, and to keep getting deeper in it is really, really good. And sometimes I feel, you know, when people appear and disappear and, you know, I run into a lot of people who were practicing and they stopped, then they come back, but it feels a lot of times like they didn't quite know why they were doing it or where they were trying to go. And that's part of why they kind of just drifted away, because it wasn't bearing fruit. So you got to know what you're doing for it to bear fruit. And then just find ways to, you know, lengthen and deepen your practice. I mean, you know, 40 minutes can seem like a long time, but part of why we do that is you get a chance to get past, maybe let go of some of the stuff and settle down a little bit towards the end. You know, there's an arc to it. So, you know, look at your own discipline, your own choices. how you orchestrate your practice life. And again, you know, push boundaries as much as you can, you know, in the balance of your family and all those other needs. Cause the difference between, you know, that extra 20 minutes of practice or practicing several times a day, or it starts to really bear fruit. It starts to shift things. So to really look at ways you can kind of move the needle so it's really going to be fruitful. You know, we kind of owe it to ourselves. And I'm, you know, in my own life, I mean, I've tried pretty hard. I have to pry out time. It's a little harder now because I'm older and my wife has some medical needs, and just it's harder for her, for me to be away. So I'm not able to do it quite as much as I used to. But, you know, I've done a lot of long retreats, month retreats, stuff like that. But they were all choices, you know. They were all choices that I made. And I know everyone that does a lot of serious practice, there's trade-offs. There's other stuff they don't do. They don't go to the south of France. They go to retreat instead, you know, or they save up their money and they don't buy a newer car. They go to retreat instead. So look at those choices and what's going to really move, what's going to move the needle. Because, you know, a longer retreat, how many people have been on kind of longish? Yeah. Like, okay, I don't know how, what's long, like 7 days, yeah. Ditto. Yeah, and then if you could do, you know, longer than that, I mean, if you do like a month-long retreat, it's amazing because after a few weeks in, it really starts to seem like all the stuff that you would normally be prone to want to think about is gone because there's no new stuff, you know, and you gave your phone away, so you don't have a phone, there's no new stuff coming in, and it really starts to be transformational. So that's worth, you know, if you're inspired to do that, it's really worth doing. So I just encourage you in 2024, if you can pull it off, to find ways, at least, you know, if you can do a week, great. If you can do longer, great. But do it, because that's part of where real change happens. You look at the monastics, you know, they do range retreats, so Ajahn Nisibo and Ajahn Kovalo. They're starting, in fact, Ajahn Nisibo's, they're starting, I think it's like in about a week and a half, they go into the winter retreat. And it's pretty much just going to go offline and stop participating. He'll still go to the Saturday, but aside from that, won't be doing emails. So just cut it off and be in practice, you know, be in deep practice. So as much as we can, that makes a huge difference. Realizing time is going to kind of speed this up a little. But I will say in 1989, I had a choice about doing long retreat because I could see an opportunity. I've been studying with a Tibetan Lama, Genla Rinpa, and he was in India, and there was an opportunity. I kind of cooked it up to go for 3 months, but I'd saved up some money a little bit, and I could have, you know, like started buying a house. I mean, it literally was that choice, and I finally decided to do the retreat because I, you know, it's like, okay, at the end of my life, if I look back, what would be more relevant? And I'm glad I did. I really am. I even had to pay 4 months of child support up front, you know, because of my first marriage. So, but it was a choice, and it really, it's still in my heart, you know, how much difference that made, how much it changed my understanding of the path. And then the last thing is, you know, just being spurred by the kiss of death. But, you know, to really think about that, because it does aliven the practice, and it is the reality. Some of you know my wife has she's got a cancer in her bladder, and which we just found out about a few weeks ago. And you know, it's hard. I mean, she's telling me this morning she's scared. And we, you know, hope everything will be all right. And a few years ago, I got two stents in my heart right now, and there was a little bit there where I could have punched out at any moment. So, point being, you know, Ellen and I have talked about this so much that we're like not surprised that, oh, death is like right looking at us, and how it is an aspect that really can put a fire under your practice, because the tinsel of life becomes much less relevant when you're faced with the end of, you know, this lifetime or just the end, depending on how you're seeing it. So to bring that right up into your life and look at it that way every day can really help. Maybe I'll stop here. I'm just going to read. I won't go into it in depth, but the four thoughts that turn the mind are from the, this is from the Dujum Tirsaram Nundro, which is a Tibetan thing. In the beginning of a long retreat in that practice, people do the four thoughts that turn the mind before they even start retreat, just to get them going. So I'm going to leave you with this without explaining it a whole lot, unless anyone has a question. They are, it is extremely difficult to find such freedom and opportunities as we have. Being impermanent, everyone who is born will die. The results of our virtuous and harmful actions are inevitable. That's the third. The fourth is the three realms we experience are an ocean of suffering. Remembering this, may my mind turn toward the Dharma. I'll read that one more time. The first, it's extremely difficult to find such freedom and opportunities as we have. The second, being impermanent, everyone who is born will die. The third, the results of our virtuous and harmful actions are inevitable. And the fourth, the three realms we experience are an ocean of suffering. Remembering this, may my mind turn toward the Dharma. So let's just sit for a moment.